Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court's end-of-term bombshells dropped today, which make it clear that the court's 6-3 supermajority of conservatives and extreme conservatives are engaged in judicial activism, which, in the case of the rulings today, make it clear that we are dealing with partisan Republican operatives in robes when it comes to decisions on elections and how they are financed. Joining us is Leah Littman, professor of law at the University of Michigan, who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy and is now a regular contributor to the Take Care blog and is the co-host and creator of Strict Scrutiny, a podcast about the U.S. Supreme Court. We will discuss the gutting of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act 8 years after Chief Justice John Roberts gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and the decision on dark money that found in favor of the Koch brothers, with Justice Alito arguing that billionaires who are shaping our politics and buying our politicians wholesale are somehow being stigmatized and having their privacy invaded if they have to reveal who and what they are buying. Then, with indictments handed down today by the Manhattan DA against Alan Weisselberg, Trump's chief financial officer, and the Trump Organization, we'll speak with a leading expert on white-collar crime, Henry Pontell, distinguished professor in the Department of Sociology and the Department of Criminal Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and professor emeritus in the Department of Criminology, Law and Society at the School of Social Ecology and the Sociology School of Social Sciences at the University of California, Irvine. We'll discuss whether these charges will be enough to get Weisselberg to flip on Trump and what further charges might be pending. Then finally, with record high temperatures in Western Canada and the Pacific Northwest, which are baking under a heat dome, we will speak with Susan Joy Hassel, the director of the nonprofit organization Climate Communication, who publishes the series Quick Facts with the American Association for the Advancement of Science's SciLine on the connection between extreme weather and climate change. She joins us to discuss her article at the New York Times, which she co-authored, Climate Change is Behind the Heat Dome, and how there are now places on the Earth where extreme temperature and extreme humidity will kill you. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Leah Littman, who's a professor of law at the University of Michigan, who teaches and writes on constitutional law, federal post-conviction review, and federal sentencing. She clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy of the United States Supreme Court and is now a regular contributor to the Take Care blog and the co-host and creator of Strict Scrutiny, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leah Littman.
Thanks for having me.
So this supermajority on the Supreme Court, the conservative 6-3 majority, have been fairly consistently putting out 6-3 rulings now. And I guess the lesson there for progressives and liberals is that voting has consequences. But what do you make of these two rulings that came down today on Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and on the California dark money case against the Koch brothers front group, Americans for Prosperity, and this ultra-conservative Thomas More Catholic Opus Dei type of operation involved in politics? What's your reading on it, Leah?
I think the general theme that unites the two cases is that when push comes to shove, the conservatives on the Roberts Court are unanimous and in lockstep when it comes to undermining the law of democracy and making it more difficult for voting rights claims to succeed. You know, we've obviously seen some rulings this term that have allowed the justices to find cross-ideological agreement and even some unanimity, but that falls apart once the cases start to involve voting rights or the law of democracy. The voting rights case you mentioned, Brnovich versus DNC, is incredibly significant because it all but effectively eliminates the one remaining protection of the Voting Rights Act. When Shelby County versus Holder in 2013 invalidated the preclearance regime of the Voting Rights Act, which required certain states to obtain federal permission before enacting any changes to their voting laws, it said that preclearance wasn't needed because Section 2, which prohibits laws that intentionally discriminate on the basis of race or laws that result in discriminatory effects on the basis of race, was sufficient to prevent racial voter suppression. But today, the court basically made it impossible for plaintiffs to succeed on Section 2 claims that argue a law has a disproportionately negative effect on voters of color. Justice Alito's opinion for the six conservatives listed a set of factors for courts to consider when assessing these voting rights claims. And the set of factors will make it easy for conservative judges to rule against voting rights claims. For example, Justice Alito said that if a voting practice or procedure was common when the amendment to the Voting Rights Act was enacted in 1982, then that effectively creates a presumption that the voting practice or procedure is perfectly lawful. That's going to make it really hard to challenge any of the recent rollbacks we've seen of more accessible voting practices or procedures, like recent rollbacks of absentee voting or early voting or voting by mail. Justice Alito's majority opinion also said that courts should consider how a voting system operates as a whole and whether voters of color have an equal opportunity to participate in that system. What that means is if a state ends one voting procedure that is used more frequently by voters of color, say early voting or absentee voting, then that procedure might still be lawful so long as the state retains other forms of voting that remain theoretically open to voters of color. So that reasoning, the legal test that the court announced, will make it extremely difficult for any plaintiffs to succeed in these Voting Rights Act challenges.
Well, when that case was heard in oral arguments before the Supreme Court, the Arizona Republican arguing against the DNC in Arizona, he admitted, didn't he, that unless you rule my way, the Democrats are going to have a demographic advantage.
Yeah, so when he was asked by Justice Barrett what the Republican Party's interest was in this case, he said every additional vote that is counted, you know, that doesn't comply with the state's restrictions is essentially harming the Republican Party. So, you know, their theory of the case was the more votes that are counted, you know, the worse for them. The more restrictive the state's voting laws, the better for them.
And indeed, Justice Alito, in the majority opinion, brought up this canard, this straw man of fraud. I mean, the last election was deemed to be absolutely fraud-free, except for a couple of, I think one or two cases where actually they were Republicans who were committing fraud, but I think in the single digits. And yet he brings it up as a justification for this ruling.
Yeah, so that's another factor that Justice Alito's majority opinion lists that courts can consider when assessing these Section 2 claims. He says courts should consider the strength of a state's interest, including that of preventing voter fraud. The reason why that is making these Section 2 challenges so difficult is, as you note, there's no evidence of any real persistent voter fraud. And yet still, the court says states get to assert that as an interest, and that interest can outweigh the fact that a law concededly and actually does disproportionately burden voters of color. So the existence of some theoretical but entirely hypothetical interest in non-existent voter fraud can prevail and outweigh the fact that a state law does harm voters of color.
And again, I'm speaking with Leah Littman, who's a professor of law at the University of Michigan, who teaches and writes on constitutional law, federal post-conviction review, and federal sentencing. She clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy of the Supreme Court and is now a regular contributor to the Take Care blog and the co-host and creator of Strict Scrutiny, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. And in her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan, I think it was a pretty clear dig at Chief Justice Roberts, who's opinion 8 years ago in gutting Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, he in justifying it, he said the country's changed, we've moved on. Well, the evidence out there is so overwhelming that we're actually moving backwards in terms of voting rights, with state legislatures controlled by Republicans around the country passing what almost 100, over 60 new laws to restrict voting. So, Leah, do you think that what kind of impact do you think this will have on the Department of Justice's recent move against Georgia? Does this cut the legs out from under Attorney General Merrick Garland?
So the Department of Justice's lawsuit in Georgia actually alleged that the Georgia law intentionally discriminated on the basis of race. Now, the court in the Arizona case also concluded that the Arizona law didn't intentionally discriminate on the basis of race. And some of the reasoning from that portion of the opinion will surely be a mark against DOJ's lawsuit. Specifically, Justice Alito said, partisan motives, the fact that a political party was seeking to entrench its own power or advantage itself, doesn't necessarily mean that the voting restriction is related to race and is intentionally discriminatory on the basis of race. And that will surely also be part of the fight in the Georgia lawsuit. So yes, what the court said in Brnovich will cut against the DOJ lawsuit, but the big part of the court's opinion in Brnovich is more about what laws have the result of discriminating on the basis of race and is less about what laws intentionally discriminate on the basis of race. So it has less to do with the Georgia lawsuit by DOJ than it might seem.
Well, President Biden today said that the court has now done severe damage to two important provisions of the Voting Rights Act. Would you agree with Biden?
So I think that this opinion does underscore the need for additional voting rights legislation and the need for the democratically controlled Congress to do something to insulate that legislation from this court. Because what the court did in Shelby County was to invalidate one key provision of the Voting Rights Act. And what the court did in Brnovich is to effectively gut the other one and interpret it in a way that it will do no work. And so the court has already mangled and undermined the piece of voting rights legislation that we have. And I think that means we need a new one in order to protect our multiracial democracy.
So do you think that this might influence, I know it's a political question, not a legal one, but do you think it might influence Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema in terms of passing the For the People Act? In other words, the writing's on the wall.
I don't pretend to have a lot of insight into all of the factors they might be weighing, but I would hope and I would think that the court effectively gutting, you know, the one protection we have against discrimination in voting would influence them, in part because, you know, the case involved Arizona. It involved two Arizona measures that would, you know, have disenfranchised several thousands of voters when the margin of victory in some Arizona statewide elections is just 10,000 votes. And so Senator Sinema, I would hope, looks at that and sees exactly what the court is allowing, you know, Republican legislators to do, you know, stack the deck in favor of Republicans for statewide and local elections.
But does that mean that, without being too cynical, that we're talking about these justices now, this supermajority of conservative justices, essentially being political operatives in robes?
I think that they are not political operatives in robes in the sense that they are not merely deciding cases based on, you know, what is going to advantage the Republican Party and what isn't. But they are deciding cases on the basis of political worldviews and jurisprudential worldviews that are informed by, for example, how serious a risk of voter fraud they think there is and how real the threat of voter suppression and discrimination on the basis of race is. And their priors on those issues do line up with the political parties that appoint them. And I think that is impossible to deny when you look at not only the breakdown of these cases, but also how they are written.
So let's turn to the dark money case, a California case, as a matter of fact, where the Koch brothers front group, the Americans for Prosperity, along with the Thomas More Society, which again is the conservative Catholic Opus Dei type of operation, they have a victory here against the state of California, who had a regime requiring transparency. That's been struck down. So this is sort of a little bit, if you go back to Citizens United, etc., remember in Citizens United, it was actually Justice Kennedy, was it not, that thought that somehow there would be disclosure, that that would happen. And of course, the Disclose Act never passed. So there's never been disclosure following the enormous influx of dark money into politics. And I don't know whether he was naive or whether, well, let me ask you this. Do you think these justices have seen what damage Citizens United has done to our politics? Just before we even get to talk about this latest blow against transparency and in favor of dark money.
I think we are seeing an important shift in the direction of the court's cases. In Citizens United, the court upheld disclosure requirements by a vote of 8-1. Only Justice Thomas would have said it is unconstitutional to force people to disclose, you know, their political contributions. But some of the fiercest conservative defenders of disclosure and reporting requirements on the court were Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia. Both of them are no longer on the court, and they have been replaced by justices who are much more sympathetic to the idea that conservatives find themselves under attack and face a lot of hostility for their political views. And I think that that leads them to be much more skeptical of transparency and disclosure and reporting requirements. So I do think that the court's opinion in Americans for Prosperity represents an important shift in how the court is going to be assessing disclosure and reporting requirements. Now it is sufficient for plaintiffs to prove, or rather to just point to some hypothetical prospect that they might face harassment rather than proving evidence of actual harassment. Similarly, the court required the state to show that it actually had used the information that it required these nonprofits to disclose to the state. So the court is making it more difficult on states to prove that they need these disclosure requirements, while at the same time making it easier for plaintiffs to challenge them. And the combination of those two things is surely going to jeopardize a lot of campaign finance regulation and disclosure requirements and transparency regarding political contributions that were previously considered safe.
Right, but when they argue in favor of a conservative's right to give money and not be somehow outed and harassed, that's not what's going on with the Koch brothers. We're talking about billionaires. I mean, they're sure they're conservative, or they're, in the case of the Koch brothers, they're libertarians. But they're also billionaires. And the problem, I guess, goes back to an earlier Supreme Court ruling that equated money with speech. But isn't it obvious that the more money you have, the more speech you have in politics? And in this case, you can have unlimited amounts of money that nobody has to know who is giving the money out. So it's really a question about the rights of billionaires versus the rights of the public to know who's buying their politics and buying their politicians.
Yes, that is absolutely one of the interests that states point to in these disclosure requirements. They say, you know, it is important for voters to know who are supporting particular causes and who are supporting particular candidates. And that information is very relevant to voters in assessing, you know, whether to vote for a particular policy or referenda or whether to vote for a particular candidate. And the court is heavily discounting that interest in favor of the interest that you name, you know, essentially the right to donate an unlimited amount of money to whatever causes you want and face absolutely no consequences for that whatsoever.
Well, Justice Sotomayor said that today's, in dissent, she said that today's analysis marks reporting and disclosure requirements with a bullseye. Regulatory entities who wish to avoid their obligations can do so by vaguely waiving First Amendment privacy concerns. Neither precedent nor common sense supports such a result. So when you hear the cogent dissents, it feels though kind of like baying into the wind, isn't it? Going back to the dissent by Ruth Bader Ginsburg against Chief Justice Roberts' ruling in gutting Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act back 8 years ago, she said, you know, it's like suddenly throwing away an umbrella in a rainstorm. I'm not quoting it exactly, but when you have these powerful dissents that are so based in common sense, as both Ruth Bader Ginsburg's back then and Sotomayor's today, it sort of leaves me feeling sad that the people with the right arguments just don't have the clout, and the people with these flimsy arguments, they got the power. Is that what it comes down to?
I mean, I think it certainly does. You know, the dissent that Justice Kagan wrote in Brnovich, the Voting Rights Act case, the dissent that Justice Sotomayor wrote in Americans for Prosperity, the California disclosure case, and the dissent that Justice Ginsburg wrote in Shelby County when the court struck down the preclearance regime of the Voting Rights Act were all incredibly powerful. They were powerful rhetorically. They were powerful on the law. They were powerful logically. They were powerful analytically. And none of that matters. And that, I think, brings it back to what we were just talking about, which is, you know, should we think about the justices as acting politically? You know, the fact that these logical, analytical arguments aren't carrying the day is one piece of evidence in that. And it really does underscore that these forceful arguments, the best arguments, the best litigators are not enough to win these cases. You know, this protecting voting rights requires congressional action and requires congressional legislation protecting voting rights, and it requires legislation protecting those voting rights protections from this court.
Well, Leah Littman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Leah Littman, who's a professor of law at the University of Michigan, who teaches and writes on constitutional law, federal post-conviction review, and federal sentencing. She clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy of the United States Supreme Court and is now a regular contributor to the Take Care blog and the co-host and creator of Strict Scrutiny, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the indictments handed down today against Trump's chief financial officer and the Trump Organization, and discuss whether these charges will be enough to get Weisselberg to flip on Trump and what further charges might be pending. It's like being on trial for your life with a public defender. Let the jury fill the seats up and start the court calendar off with docket number 9mm. All rise, the Honorable Jay-Z preside. Instead of a mallet, I hold a tool. All objections overruled. Save your opening arguments. Hope you understand it. Two guns, right over left. That's how I cross-examine. Like Tom Cruise, popping with the top gun. You lose. No lie, and y'all can't handle the truth. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henry Pontell, who's Professor Emeritus in the Department of Criminology, Law and Society, and Sociology at the University of California, Irvine, and a Distinguished University Professor in the Department of Sociology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, the former president of the White Collar Crime Research Consortium of the National White Collar Crime Center. His books include International Handbook of White Collar and Corporate Crime, Profit Without Honor, White Collar Crime and the Looting of America, and Big Money, Crime, Fraud, and the Politics in the Savings and Loan Crisis. And he's the co-author of a new study in the journal Crime, Law, and Social Change, In Your Face Watergate, Neutralizing Government Lawbreaking and the War Against White Collar Crime. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Pontell.
Thank you very much, Ian. Nice to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. In your paper that we just referred to, Watergate, Neutralizing Government, Lawbreaking, and the War Against White Collar Crime, you begin by saying ample official evidence exists that the Trump administration was the most corrupt in modern American history. Since the inauguration itself, which is under investigation for various funding illegalities, it remains embroiled in a number of alleged improprieties, some of which include involvement with foreign interference by Russia in the 2016 election, emoluments violations, family self-dealing while in office, extortion in Ukraine, withholding and unduly influencing vital information on a deadly pandemic, obstruction of justice, fraudulent fundraising efforts, election interference, promoting a seditious use of the judicial process in the wake of a losing election effort, and inciting a mob to storm the Capitol building that resulted in multiple deaths and injuries. So what was handed down today by the Manhattan DA in terms of indictments against the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, Alan Weisselberg, and the Trump Organization, how do they stand up to the list that I just read, Henry?
Well, it's really not a surprise. As you say, as you related from my paper, this is a person who has been involved in so many different scandals. Whether or not he was legally adjudicated as being guilty, it really isn't the point. I don't believe he resembles and amplifies the behavior of notorious white-collar criminals, corporate criminals and the like. So it really isn't a surprise. This was, you know, you can look at the number of years it took and the legal wrangling that took place just to get his tax returns. What happened today would never have happened unless there were there were court decisions that were allowed the prosecutors access to those records. In most, in all financial crime cases, you need to get tax records. You need to follow the money. And whether or not this was intentional on his part to hide the tax records and to basically break the norm of all presidents in the recent past having turned over their taxes, that remains to be seen. But looking at this list of things that he's been closely associated with, and his family's been closely associated with, and his associates have been closely associated with, I really think that it was not just a coincidence that he tried to keep his tax returns a secret, because what we saw today is the culmination of that disclosure.
So notwithstanding that there may be a lot of wishful thinking on the part of progressives and liberals who have been watching this crime in action for some time, not just the 4 years of ruinous regime of the Trump administration, but as this indictment today talks about running a 15-year scheme to help executives avoid paying taxes by compensating them off the books. But given that they've got Alan Weisselberg on dodging taxes on $1.7 million in perks, that may not be enough for him to spend much time in jail, if any. And isn't the whole idea to put him in jail for a while in order to get him to flip?
Yeah, that's true. The charges that came down don't look like much, but we'll see how far they go in terms of jail and prison time. I don't think, you know, he's been with Trump for decades, and to think that he was going to flip quickly would be wishful thinking. He may never flip. It really depends on what happens in his case. And of course, that's going to be a long drawn out legal battle unless they come through with much more evidence than they've shown in the indictment. Already, the Trump organization and Trump himself has started to make this a political enterprise, but, and it's not, it's a legal proceeding. But of course, when, you know, there's nothing you can depend on in the law, you have to go elsewhere. And he's got his base, and he's going to try to politicize this as much as possible, which is nonsense. Those issues don't hold up in court. So it's going to be based on the evidence. I should say that also I believe that the prosecutors, when they bring these kinds of cases, they're pretty airtight. So instead of trying to come up with a very long indictment, you know, it's long enough. It's 15 counts, I believe, and it's, you know, the money and the is considerable, and so are the so is the indictment of the organization. But there's probably much more to come. I really see this as the first volley of the government. These cases take a long time. They've had the tax documents now for I think a year or two. And there's millions and millions of pages to go through. The government does not want to bring a case where there's going to be uncertainty, especially when you're dealing with this kind of organization. And Trump, as a person, he uses the legal apparatus as both a weapon and a shield. And he's done so throughout his entire business life and also during his political life. So we know what to expect. We expect to see a lot of distraction. We expect to see a lot of politicalization. and to drag this out as long as possible so that other things can come into play that might take our gaze off of this particular case. But I don't, you know, I really think that this will probably produce convictions. Not sure it's going to produce a flip in terms of Weisselberg, but there are other people that could yet to be that are yet to be indicted, and I think there are going to be other indictments.
Yeah, there's one actually referred to, an unindicted co-conspirator, not named, but the New York Times was reporting that Trump and the Trump Organization manipulated property values to obtain loans and tax benefits, which of course was what, during his testimony, Michael Cohen, Trump's fixer and lawyer, basically flagged that, didn't he? I mean, he pointed the prosecutors, go after
Correct.
This.
Right? That's right. That's right. Michael Cohen, you know, Michael Cohen flipped, of course, after he was thrown under the bus, and he's given them lots of leads and lots of places to look for in the maze of documents that they have to go through. And I think, you know, coming back to the Weisselberg connection again, we haven't seen yet whether or not the prosecutors are going to threaten his family. And Michael Cohen, in his book and also on his media appearances, brings up the point that he wasn't very pleased when the feds were threatening to indict his wife. And actually, he got very indignant about it, as if, you know, the fact that they were using the law against basically an organized crime ring that he was part of was somehow out of bounds and not moral. And I think he's still a bit indignant about that, but it did get him to finally say enough's enough. So we don't know what's going to happen with Weisselberg as things get a little bit more complicated here. But I think this is the first volley, and I think that it's probably pretty rock. Knowing how prosecutors operate in these situations, I would expect it to be rock solid. That's not to say that the defense is going to try to pick it apart and use everything in the arrow in their quiver to try to dilute it, but I really think that they wouldn't be bringing this many charges unless they had the absolute proof. Another thing I'll say is that in many of these complex white-collar crime cases, you don't see a big picture indictment. Many times, and most times, you'll see various indictments on particular frauds that were committed as part of a much larger picture. So, you know, this gives some relief to those who want to believe that the defendant really didn't do it. But that's not the point. The point is, there's no need for prosecutors to indict on every single thing, because chances are there's going to be too many things they'd approve, and evidence is going to be not solid in every single particular chain of events, even though it's almost certain that these things took place. But legally, they're not going to do that. They're going to go after these what they call rifle shots. You know, we got tax fraud. Good. We have this many counts. Great. What does it produce? About 5-10 years, maybe a maximum of 15. Perfect. They don't have to go after the whole enchilada all at once.
And again, I'm speaking with Henry Pontell, who's a professor emeritus in the departments of criminology, law and society, and sociology at the University of California, Irvine, and a distinguished university professor in the Department of Sociology at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, the former president of the White Collar Crime Research Consortium of the National White Collar Crime Center. His books include International Handbook of White Collar and Corporate Crime, Profit Without Honor, White Collar Crime and the Looting of America, and Big Money Crime, Fraud and Politics in the Savings and Loan Crisis. And he's the co-author of a new study in the journal Crime, Law and Social Change, In Your Face Watergate, Neutralizing Government Lawbreaking and the War Against White Collar Crime. So given that not only Weisselberg's been indicted, but the Trump organization's been indicted. And again, they're really not letting, as you pointed out, they're not necessarily letting out everything they know, and they're not going to go after everything that they know that the Trump organization has done. But do you think that they're building a RICO case?
It's very possible they are. And in fact, if they have the evidence, if they can find it in the paperwork and put it together, as a structured fraud, there's very little doubt that they're going to go that route, because that would be the ultimate weapon that they could employ if people aren't going to come forward.
Well, given that Trump was tutored by Roy Cohn, and Roy Cohn, of course, handed off his account to Roger Stone, Trump has always had contempt for the law, and he's always had this kind of wannabe mafia boss type attitude in among his sort of many fantasies about who he is. We've seen interviews with him while he was president talking about, oh, I've known flippers all my life, and all this kind of mob talk, you know. So do you think that this is eventually going to catch up with him? I mean, I read in your recent study at the Journal of Crime, Law, and Social Change, the bill of particulars is almost endless against this guy. He's been one step ahead of the sheriff all of his professional life. So I understand why people are anxious that justice prevails here. So in a broader sense, you know, he's not Bernie Madoff. There's no smoking guns. But he's just a spectacularly mobbed up guy all of his life. So do you get the feeling in any way that there's going to be a reckoning here? Because given the absolute ardor of Trump's base and the support that he has amongst these deluded people who watch Fox News and have a completely, you know, delusional picture of who this man is, you're really going to have to nail him with something good to break that spell, aren't you, Henry?
Yeah, I agree. I agree fully. And that's why I think this is so important. I've been saying for a while now that the legal process, as slow as it is, needs to be brought down quickly, effectively, and as much as possible, whether it's civil suits, criminal indictments, federal, state. There are so many things here. And of course, he does not have the protective shield of the presidency. While you're absolutely right, he still has a protective shield, but not a legal one, of a base that he continues to feed this raw meat and lies about the election, et cetera. But, you know, let's give him credit as a white-collar criminal. I see him as a quintessential white-collar criminal. He was president of the United States. He incited a riot, that an insurrection on the Capitol. That's pretty heavy stuff. So in order to quell that, as you say, is there any hope for this? I really think that the way to douse that whole movement and, you know, send back the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and the white supremacists and all the other folks among them, that we really need to enforce the law. And we need to do it as quickly and as effectively as possible. And today I see this as the first, you know, again, the first volley. That, unfortunately, you know, with white collar crime cases, things, and especially things this the complexities involved in financial fraud, these things don't move quickly. But I think they've moved as probably as quickly as they can. And I think that we need to see a pylon here, basically, to just silence, you know, getting them off Twitter and Facebook is clearly not enough. He is really good at what he does. He's been a professional grifter all his life, disguised as a legitimate business person, which is, you know, quite the essence of a white collar criminal. So I do give him credit for that. In terms of being effective, he was elected president of the United States, for God's sake. But, you know, as you say, the hope would be, in my mind, the hope to basically quell all of this nonsense that's going on and the threats to our democracy would be to come down on him and his organization as quickly and as effectively as possible and leave the base and other Republicans in Congress, et cetera, holding signs that say, you know, Republicans for Corruption Unite. That's all that it's been about for the last, you know, year or two or more with him in office. So now that he's out of office, I think his vulnerability is there. His Achilles heel, I think, will be seen soon if the legal system can move fast enough.
So just in the last minute then, given that the Republicans are defending the indefensible in terms of what happened on January the 6th and are trying, they have an alternative reality, an alternative narrative that somehow it wasn't the Trump supporters who stormed the Capitol, but it was Antifa and Black Lives Matter. They're sticking with him. They didn't want to have an investigation. And now Pelosi's standing up an investigation. But do you think, and I think you've just indicated that, if there's some serious criminality exposed in these trials in the trials that are about to begin and further indictments that are expected, do you think then that that will give the Republicans an excuse? Because I can't imagine they really, even McCarthy himself is being so supine, and McConnell obviously hates him too privately, but he's stuck with him. Do you think that they'll seize the opportunity to cut bait once there's enough criminality exposed?
It's difficult to say because there have been so many opportunities for them to do that, and instead they've followed him down the rabbit hole. Again, it's, you know, they're trying to hold on to their positions, and it's all about power at this point. They want to be reelected, but I think that's part of the conundrum here for them. The more they follow him down this rabbit hole, which they've done, the more risk is involved in terms of their losing their positions. There's going to be a reconciliation at some point, and I think that's going to have to happen at the ballot box. And there are lots of folks who are thinking that there aren't going to be a lot of Republicans back in office, given their attitudes towards, you know, January 6th and everything else. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, of course, what they're trying to do is fix the voting process itself, because that's all they have left to work with. So again, following him down this rabbit hole has led them into a very, very dark corner of, as you say, a non-reality regarding what's actually going on. I think this new committee that Pelosi put together today has the opportunity to, and also what the New York Times did with that terrific video, has the there's some hope there that this is going to eventually keep chiseling away at that base until it's much less effective than it is now, and hopefully that will turn some of these politicians around. But right now, the Republicans are in a very, very dark place, and they seem content to be there.
Well, Henry Pontell, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure. Pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you, Henry. And again, I've been speaking with Henry Pontell, who's a professor emeritus in the Departments of Criminology, Law and Society and Sociology at the University of California, Irvine, and a distinguished university professor in the Department of Sociology at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's the author of International Handbook of White Collar and Corporate Crime, Profit Without Honor, White Collar Crime and the Looting of America. And he's the co-author of a new study at the Journal of Crime, Law and Social Change, In Your Face Watergate, Neutralizing Government Lawbreaking and the War Against White Collar Crime. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the record high temperatures in Western Canada and the Pacific Northwest and the connection between extreme weather and climate change.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world, but the Murphy family is my boss. The voters of the world keep supporting me. I promise to take you very far. Other mothers better not upset me, or I'll send a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me to win, I sincerely like to thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Susan Joy Hassell, who is the director of the nonprofit organization Climate Communication. She publishes the series Quick Facts with the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, SciLine, on the connections between extreme weather and climate change. And she's the co-author of an article at the New York Times, Climate Change is Behind the Heat Dome. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Joy Hassell.
Thank you very much, Ian. Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the heat dome, which is affecting the Pacific Northwest and the Western Canadian province of British Columbia, has caused the temperature to rise in that country to break a record. And it's the highest the country's ever experienced. And that's a temperature of 121.3 degrees Fahrenheit, almost 50 degrees centigrade. And that is in a small town of Lytton, which happens to have burned to the ground because of a wildfire. So yeah, that is what's just happened in Canada, and it's shaken up the country, and the heat dome is moving to the east, so it's not going away. So let's talk about the heat dome itself and the condition that you referred to in your article at the New York Times, known as an omega block pattern. So what's a heat dome?
So a heat dome is this area of high pressure, and it stays in place for a longer time now than it used to because of this omega block. And that has to do with the changes that we've caused in the jet stream. The jet stream is wavier now. It dips down in larger waves. And then these special areas of weather, like this heat dome, can get trapped and locked in place. And then there'll be other places in the world where it's very wet, and they're going to find that they're having very heavy rain and flooding. So we get this kind of both ends of the spectrum of extreme weather. And that's only one of the ways that we know that climate change is affecting heat waves.
Well, it's already causing an enormous death toll in British Columbia. Yeah. They've recorded 486 deaths over 5 days. Yes. And also in Vancouver, British Columbia's biggest city, there are 65 people have died since Friday. And then here in the United States, the state of Oregon, they've had 60 deaths from extreme heat. And of course, the state of Washington, of course, is experiencing extraordinary heat as well and an alarming death toll. So this has never happened before, right?
Well, certainly not in that part of the country. I mean, we're seeing temperatures 30 to 35 degrees above normal, and they're setting records. They're not just breaking records, they're smashing them by several degrees. So it's really off the charts. And I think what, you know, we mentioned all of these deaths and all this illness, and I think what people don't recognize is that heat is actually the deadliest form of extreme weather in the United States. It kills more people than floods and hurricanes combined on average every year. So people don't realize how deadly heat is. People die of heat stroke, heat exhaustion. Lots of people are hospitalized. People get dehydrated. And it's really a very, very devastating from a medical point of view. And it's also very costly. Sometimes power goes out. We've seen power cables melt. We've seen streets and roads buckle from the heat, rail lines buckling in the heat. So this is no small inconvenience or just some discomfort. This is a major, deadly, and costly event.
Well, the irony is, of course, Susan, that when you have extreme heat here in the United States, people travel north to get away from the extreme heat to Canada, or here in California when it gets really hot, people go up to Oregon and Washington State. But now they're the hottest spots of all. I mean, it's pretty close to the highest temperatures we've ever had here in the United States, or actually on the planet, and that is 130 degrees in Death Valley here in Southern California.
Yeah, it really is remarkable. And as we say in our piece in the New York Times, it's, you know, in the old days, people would escape summer heat by heading north, as you say, right? But this is not your grandparents' climate. We are now in a really very different climate regime, and it's happened even faster than the climate models have predicted. And that's something that gets climate scientists very concerned.
And when you have a village in British Columbia, the village of Lytton, having the highest temperature ever recorded in Canada of 121.3 degrees Fahrenheit, and as a result of a wildfire, it burns to the ground. Surely that's a harbinger of what kind of fall we're going to have. The fire season's normally in the fall. So we've got all of the summer baking to dry out forests and brush. And then I'm really not looking forward to the fire season, particularly here in Southern California.
No, and that's what's happened. Fire season has become year-round, really, now in California. It's become much longer. And, you know, all you need to have a fire is heat, drought, and dead trees, and climate change is giving us all three. So the snowpack is melting earlier, and so there's less water in the rivers and streams, less water for ecosystems when they need them, and everything dries out. And You just don't have the water when you need it in the summer. So, yeah, the heat wave season is also getting longer. You know, global warming has done a number of things to heat waves that we have measured and that we now see the trends of. They come earlier, right? This was quite early in the season, starting in June, right? Rather than waiting for the dog days of summer of July and August. So these heat waves are more frequent. They last longer. They cover larger areas. They're hotter. And the nights don't cool off. And that's really important from a human health perspective, because when the nights don't cool off that much, that's the time that people would normally recover from the really hot days. And so now we've got these longer, hotter heat waves without the ability to recover. And it's not a good situation. And particularly in a place like the Northwest, where few people have air conditioning because they've never needed it.
And again, I'm speaking with Susan Joy Hassel, who is the director of the nonprofit organization Climate Communication. She publishes the series Quick Facts with the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, SciLine, on the connections between extreme weather and climate change. And she's the co-author of an article at the New York Times, Climate Change is Behind the Heat Dome. And of course, in 2019, the Europeans went through a heat wave that killed 2,500 people. So obviously, it's a global phenomenon, and as you point out, it most certainly has something to do with global warming. But we've had another phenomenon which I find extraordinary and alarming, and that is that there have been temperatures of 50 degrees centigrade, that's 122 degrees Fahrenheit, in some parts of the world, in Pakistan's Indus River Valley and some other locations in the Persian Gulf, where you have this phenomenon known as a wet bulb temperature, where you have both high temperatures and high humidities. And this phenomenon means that people being subjected to this climate simply die. The human body cannot cope with it. So the idea that there are parts on our planet now where, because of climate change, creating weather conditions that mean that you can't live on this planet. I just find that so alarming. And is this likely to get worse? And if you don't mind, for the benefit of our audience, explaining a little bit to us, Susan, about what a wet bulb means. Because the problem is that humans cannot survive exposure to a wet bulb temperature because there's no way to cool our bodies, not even in the shade, and not right. even with unlimited water.
Yeah, yeah. So we can't thermoregulate. We control the temperature in our body by sweating. And if the temperature is high enough and the humidity is high enough, you can't sweat and have that evaporate off your body. It just won't happen. And so you can't cool off. And your body temperature starts to rise to the point where the heat just kills you. And we now are seeing that in places on Earth, not for very long. But we have seen it now. We've measured those temperatures. So the question now is, what direction are we going to go? Are we going to continue on the path we are? And the science shows that if we stay on the path we are with increasing emissions of the heat-trapping gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and so forth, that are causing global warming, come from the burning of fossil fuels, the clearing of forests, and some other activities. If we stay that course, we are going to see that expand. Research has shown that now that's much less than 1% of the Earth's surface where that kind of temperature would be possible. But that would increase to about 19 or 20% of the Earth's surface 50 years from now if we stay the current course of increasing emissions. But it doesn't have to be that way. We can take another path, really. That's the interesting part of being at this moment in time. The choice is ours. If we continue going down a path that leads us to global catastrophe, or if we quickly act to rapidly transition to a clean energy system, which is good for lots of other reasons too. And if we do that, we will still have a little more global warming, but it will be a small amount more, and we will be able to adapt to it and live with it. So that really is the choice we face, with a little more warming that we can deal with, or a lot more and have a global catastrophe. You know, there are at least several ways of dealing with climate change. One is what the scientists call mitigation, which means reducing our emissions to reduce future climate change. That's the big one. The other one, the second one, is adaptation, which means changes we make to live with the impacts that are already on the way. So, for example, adding more air conditioning, you know, for people is considered an adaptation to higher heat. But of course, if you're getting your energy from burning fossil fuels, then it's a vicious cycle where you put in more air conditioning and you're going to get more heat, even more heat. So we have to be a little bit careful about how we adapt, right? And the third thing that we're going to do, besides reduce our emissions to stop future climate change and adapt, the third piece is suffer. And the pieces of that pie are movable. To the extent that we reduce our emissions, we'll have to adapt less and we'll suffer less. To the extent that we fail to reduce our emissions, we'll have to adapt more and we'll suffer more.
Well, it seems to me, though, the idea of this wet bulb, meaning that people on this planet simply die because of the temperature and the climate. And it makes me think, my God, you know, the Earth could end up like Mars, I mean, or, you know, another planet where it's completely inhospitable to human life. The whole idea of our planet is that it's been hospitable to human life. But we humans are creating conditions that are changing the climate to the point where people will die simply because of the weather. And you just said, what, by 2040 or 2050, 19% of the planet will be subject to this kind of wet bulb temperature?
Well, the research that I was referring to there was talking about what it would take for humans to thrive. So they wouldn't necessarily die instantly from too high of a wet bulb temperature. But, you know, human society, human civilization has developed within a very narrow window of climate over the last 10,000 years. It's been quite stable. It's allowed us to produce agricultural crops that we need and the water and the energy we need and so forth. Once we move outside of that hospitable climate regime, we will find ourselves unable to grow food. So it's not just human life that has to exist. It's the ecosystems around us. It's our agricultural system and our water system. We don't live without food and water. And all of the ecosystems on Earth, the trees and the other plants, the other animals that help provide the environment in which we thrive, they are also susceptible to these very high temperatures. So, you know, of course, as we've seen, these very high temperatures and dry conditions can lead to fires. And that is, you know, devastating to ecosystems as well. So, you know, as you mentioned, this town in Canada was just essentially burned to the ground. 90% of it is gone. And, you know, those are not conditions where human society thrives.
Well, but this seems to me to be the ultimate kind of wake-up call that Mother Nature is screaming out saying, this is where you're heading. So, I don't know. I mean, I know you're trying to alert the public to the dangers of global warming, the consequences of human activity that's causing it, and how we've got a limited amount of time to deal with this. I mean, are the Canadians waking up? I mean, they've been, at least their government has been pushing this tar sands oil, which has just been finally stopped by activists here in the United States and in Canada. But the fact that they're feeling this temperature, I mean, you know, I don't think they have the same problem with global warming denying as the United States does, but I mean, is this just a case where things have got to get so damn bad that people wake up? And the question is, will they wake up in time?
Well, it's a good and important question. People don't necessarily associate extreme weather and climate change, even though it's so obvious and they should. And people like us are out there trying to help them make those connections and understand it. But, you know, there's a very active, very well-funded disinformation campaign that is out there constantly shouting down any connection between extreme weather and climate change. They'll say, well, we've always had heat waves. Well, sure, we've had heat waves, but they haven't been this hot or this frequent or this long-lasting or this deadly. And climate change is what has caused that exacerbation of that type of extreme weather and other types of extreme weather as well. Another problem is, frankly, that the media often do not do a good job of making these connections, connecting the dots between extreme weather and climate change. So there's an organization called Media Matters for America, and they analyze all the media coverage of many things, including extreme weather events. And what they find consistently is that while the media are reporting on the extreme events, they're not making the connections to climate change. So there was a terrible heat wave in Colorado recently. Only 4% of all the coverage in the media of that heat wave even mentioned climate change. 96% of it didn't even mention it. So how are people to know? You think that this is going to wake everybody up, but they're only going to wake up if they're let know about it. So one of the reasons that I publish these quick facts for any story is for journalists to help them connect the dots between the extreme weather we're all experiencing and climate change. So when people have these, you know, teachable moments where Mother Nature is really giving us a very difficult lesson, we need to learn that lesson, but we're only going to learn it if we connect the dots.
Well, Susan Joy Hassel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it was my pleasure to talk with you, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Susan Joy Hassel, who is the director of the nonprofit organization Climate Communication. She publishes the series Quick Facts with the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, SciLine, on the connections between extreme weather and climate change. And she's the co-author of an article at the New York Times, Climate Change is Behind the Heat Dome. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Stay.